Hello and welcome to KUCI FM 88.9. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett and you're listening to Writers on Writing. Today is Wednesday, September 22nd, 2016, and my guests are Rob Spillman and Lee Eisenman. First up is Rob Spillman. Rob Spillman is editor and co-founder of Tin House Literary Magazine, and his writing has appeared in book form, The Boston Review, Connoisseur, Details, GQ, Nerve, The New York Times Book Review, Rolling Stone, Salon, Spin, Sports Illustrated, etc. And he's done so much, and I'm sort of abbreviating his bio here, which you can find more by going to his website, but he's here primarily today to talk about his new memoir, All Tomorrow's Parties, published by Grove Atlantic. Hi, Rob.
Hi. Hi, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, yeah. Great to have you. Let's begin by you talking a little bit about how All Tomorrow's Parties came about.
Well, I grew up in Berlin and went back there when the wall came down, and it was kind of a formative experience for me, and I wanted to try to get to the bottom of that. And you would think as a professional editor and writer, I would be able to get there pretty quickly, but it took me 10 years to write, to figure out the form and figure out the material, and about seven of those years were just nonstop struggle, sort of Sisyphusian. I would push the material up the hill and then it would roll back down on me. And it wasn't until 7 years in that I found the form that it is in now.
So say a little bit more about that in terms of finding the form.
Well, I've been dining out on my own story for a long time, which, I can glibly say I grew up in the gay opera world with a single gay father in Berlin, and, I was sort of like Eloise in the Plaza there, but to really unpack it and figure out, my own culpability in my story, and also make it a story. Vivian Gornick talks about the situation in the story, you have your glib two sentences that describes your situation, but that doesn't actually make for a narrative. You have to use your fictive tools in memoir to actually tell a compelling story. So it took me a long time to figure that out.
Mm. I love the memoir. I love that it's doing a few different things. It's a love story. It's a history lesson. It's a story about family. It's a romp. And I would imagine that all of those threads, that it would be difficult sort of figuring out how to balance the threads. Was that ever part of what you were dealing with?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, though. But yes, that was the juggling act was part of the struggle. And with memoir, the challenge is paring down, and also the goalposts keep moving. Every day you have new knowledge and new information. You can always add, but as with fiction, you have to actually just pare down and make everything that actually pushes the story forward in there. And so, yes, it was definitely a challenge trying to juggle those. And I loved being edited as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great time being edited. It gave me even more appreciation for actually what I do, and also the inability for writers to see their own work. Because I had been working on the book for 9 years when I turned it over to my editor, and she just pointed out things that should have been obvious,
mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, yes, of course those two things are connected, and, or what if we just cut this whole chapter? And, I would go, wait, but that, my eighth year was vitally important to me, and she would be like, well, but it doesn't move the story forward. And I'm
right.
Like, oh, okay, you're right.
Was there a lot that you did cut that you had to let go, and
yes.
How was that?
Yes, yes, there were, there were some things, when people talk about kill their darlings, there were some things that were just really great bits of information, but they kind of violated the rules I had set for myself for the book. You know, I didn't put anything in post 1990, and there were some great things that I could have dropped in there, but and I actually tried, and my editor flagged them. You know, she was like, "No, that's just completely violating, the airtightness of the book."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I first heard you talk about the memoir when you were on a panel at AWP back in April in LA, and I remember thinking by your few words of description that it was sort of like a log line. You know, I mean, it was very quickly I sort of knew what sort of memoir I would be reading, and it did kind of fulfill the promise. And I don't know if coming up with a pitch line or coming up with a log line or a sentence or two about what your book is or was helped in any way. I mean, did you refine that as time went on, or did you find after you wrote the book you just, you know, it kind of reduced down to a couple of sentences where you could say what it was and someone would get what it was?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, as I was writing it, you know, like, people would ask me, like, what is it? And if I couldn't answer that question, I knew I was in trouble, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, that is a thing when you're writing a book. You actually don't know sometimes when you're in the middle of it. You know, all of my writer friends go through that when they're in the middle of a project, even, you know, an award-winning project. You just don't know it until you emerge from it, and you don't think that you're going to emerge from it. So as I got closer to the end, I was clearer about what I was trying to do, and that gave me the ability to start talking about it as well.
I'd love to hear you read.
Okay. I would be happy to. I'm going to read from the beginning, towards the beginning, when I have come back to Berlin right after the wall has come down, and a group of young East Germans have taken my wife, Elisa, and myself. We were just married. We were 25 years old, to a warehouse on the edge of the wall in the middle of the night, with a promise of going to a rave, and we have no idea what a rave is because it's 1990. So, here, you will need this, Michael says, and hands me a small plastic flashlight. I aim the light at Elisa, who gives me a questioning look, and I shrug. Bitte, gehen Sie jetzt, a young man says, impatiently pointing his flashlight toward the water-stained back of the room. His eyes are all pupil, and he is sweating, his jaw fiercely working over a piece of gum. I wave goodbye to Michael and follow the sweating man to the other side of the room, white-tiled, and through a set of steel doors that lead to a stairwell. Banish all bad thoughts. We're not going to get rolled. It's all good. Follow the signs. I squeeze Elisa's hand to reassure her and myself. We skip down one flight of steps, then another, trying to keep up with our hopped-up leader. Two floors below street level, our Orpheus pushes open a creaky black metal door, revealing a vast flooded basement, strewn with rubble and industrial detritus. Was gibt's, I ask, and our guide snorts. He explains in German, which I quickly translate for Elisa, that we are in an old ball-bearing factory. He tells me this as he dances across long, sagging boards stretched between cinder block islands. Our flashlight beams ricochet off the oily water, which has a ferrous, noxious reek, and I picture my foot dissolving in it as if it were sulfuric acid. A faint, far-off beat, a fast, steady thump-thump-thump matches the pulse in my ears. Is there another room to the factory? I call after our guide, repeating the question in English for Elisa. No, no, he replies. The party isn't in here. This is only the passageway. Before I can begin to think about where we are heading, on the other side of the waterlogged basement, a 6-foot-wide hole opens into a dank tunnel. The thump, thump, thump of music is now clear, and up ahead a bright light pulls me forward. Entschuldigung, excuse me, my new friend says, shining his flashlight over my shoulder. I turn around and Elisa catches up to us. She gives me her, what have you gotten me into look, and I give her my, you agreed to this, look back. I also silently give her what I hope is reassurance, and I think she's on the same page, but I really don't care, because we're obviously on the cusp of something weird and quite possibly wonderful. Where are we? I once more ask our guide, who snorts again and moves aside so that we can be the first to step through the hole and into a cavernous space constructed of gray granite blocks, the vaulted ceiling sweeping up a good 100 feet. People are dancing everywhere, on piles of paving stones and railroad ties and in the long trench that runs through the center of the giant space. They are dancing to the loud, steady, bass-heavy electronic music, something that sounds like Kraftwerk crossed with Donna Summer. The dancers cast huge shadows from the low, icy white strobe lights ringing the room. Atop a Lincoln Log-like construction of scavenged railroad ties perched two sets of turntables and two young men with black bubble headphones who are bobbing along to the music. "Where are we?" I shout. "Under the wall," our guide yells. "This is an old subway station from before the war, closed off for 40 years. Now we break through and have a rave." "I never want to leave," I say out loud. I think, "I can't believe this. We are literally between countries, under two countries." I close my eyes and let the concussive bass vibrate through my body. I can feel the beat of my heart aligning with the beat of the music. I'm dissolving, breaking into a million particles. I am nowhere. I am home.
Love that scene. That was Rob Spillman reading from All Tomorrow's Parties, published by Grove Atlantic. That was such a visceral scene, and so many in this book are, if not all. And I'm curious if you kept a journal during that time, or you took notes, or how did you get it so right?
Well, thank you. Yes, I did keep extensive journals at the time. That was about all I could write. I felt sort of overwhelmed by the experience. So I did keep a lot of journals. And also my wife kept extensive journals, which were equally helpful because she wrote down things that I didn't write down. And so they triggered memories. And we had sort of overlapping, you know, she was observing different things or saw things from a different angle and saw my own kind of myopia as it was happening that I was not catching.
Well, you know, that brings up another topic or question on my part, which is, in writing creative nonfiction, and writing this book, how much latitude did you give yourself in terms of embellishing or I don't know, I guess embellishing is the right word. And when you publish writers of essays for Tin House, how much latitude do they get in terms of embellishing, or I don't want to say making things up, but you know,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah, it's a really hard question, and you know, I try to be true to my memory, but you know, what happens when you're working on a project for so long, you know, the layers of memory get, you know, overwritten, you know, so when you start revising something, it's like, am I remembering this, or am I remembering writing this? So, you know, really trying to think back, but I tried to be as true to the experience as I could, you know, which was hard, you know, because it was a very intense, chaotic experience. And, you know, I showed it to my parents and, you know, and interviewed them and about my, you know, my early childhood, because I felt less certain about that because I was very young, and that was also very informative. You know, they had corrections and ideas and things that they disagreed with, but you know, at the end it was in my memory. And, you know, as far as Tin House goes, I ask the same questions I ask myself. You know, is this, you know, are you embellishing? Are you making things up here? Or, you know, if so, are you, what are you moving around? I mean, if you are changing the color of something, you know, we can talk about that. But if you're, like, inventing a person, I would have more trouble with that.
What about changing names to protect
Definitely. I did that in my book to protect, you know, people that are not public figures.
Right.
Because there's some illegal activity that I didn't want to drag them through.
Yeah. Well, you know, also then because I was going to ask you about your parents and your wife and your friend mm-hmm. who's called Hank in the book. And, mm-hmm. you know, how much you considered what they might think or feel as you were writing, and then how much you took into consideration how they might feel about what you wrote after you had a draft or after you were close to having perhaps a final.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, you know, being married to a writer who's also a central character, and it was a great challenge. And when I showed Elisa the first draft of the manuscript, she was like, okay, you've started something, that's good, but this Elisa character is so boring, I just want to punch her in the face. So I realized that I had been overly protective, to say the least, to the point of almost erasing her. So I had to actually put her in the book, and also put myself in the book. I had to make myself as complicated as I was at the time. So that was a challenge. But I with my parents, I was trying to be true to my feelings at the time, but also bringing in my knowledge of them now. And also, I have two kids, so that has changed the way I view my own parents' life. But I showed it to both of my parents when I still could make changes. And my father basically said, oh, you've made art out of your life. Great. Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks later, he called me up and said, but that scene where I planted money on you and to smuggle into East Berlin, I would never do that, would I? And I was like, yes, that's a pretty formative memory, Dad. I can still feel that the U.S. dollar is in my sock, Mm-hmm. My mother, on the other hand, was pretty upset by the book. She, throughout the book, I say, oh, surely she must have known about this or that, and apparently not. Mm. I was really good at hiding a lot of things, and also how I felt as a teenager. So she still lives in Baltimore, and she came up to New York with the manuscript, and we spent 5 hours going over it together. With her saying, did you really feel this way? And did this really happen? And that was really tough. Dorothy Allison told me years ago that when writing memoir, you have to be able to sit in the room with the people you're writing about. Mm-hmm. And I thought she meant that metaphorically, not literally. And but it was, I had to really own everything I wrote, and also be willing to change things that I didn't, wasn't absolutely certain about, whether they were good for the book or not. And so I did change things after talking to my mother.
Well, I think, I don't know if you dealt with this in writing All Tomorrow's Parties, but I think one aspect of writing memoir that can be most trying, perhaps, is maintaining suspense. And mm-hmm. you did that quite well, especially with the threat of Alyssa's health. And I mm-hmm. wondered if that was there from the beginning, or as you were going through drafts, if you asked yourself, now, what keeps the reader turning the page here, and mm-hmm. what sort of things can I use to create suspense? Was that ever part of writing this?
Yes. I didn't come to the form of alternating chapters between my growing up in Berlin and going back to Berlin until 7 years in. That's when I found that form. And the struggle before that was by the time I got back to Berlin and Elisa and her health, I was so bored with myself that that the book just felt dead on arrival. And so I didn't have anything except for time moving the book forward. And once I settled on that structure, I was able to put that more forward and create the sort of ticking clock that a little bit of suspense.
Mm-hmm. And along with that, Absinthe is very much a character in this mm-hmm. book, which was interesting because I started reading this around the time somebody brought a bottle over to my house and like, okay, this is what this is. Interesting. Yeah. You've written the book in both first person present and first person past tense. Can you talk about why both?
Well, it allowed me to vary the forms of the book and also create tension by putting those sections in the present tense. It created a little more immediacy and hopefully a little more drama. And it also allowed me to manipulate time a little bit. I was able to refer to things in one section before they happen, coming up, and put an expectation about them. You know, so like the car crashes I went through, I was able to reference them in the Berlin present tense, and so that you had an expectation of things that were going to come up. And so that just allowed me to manipulate time a little bit and have fun with the structure.
Yeah, and those car crashes, what is it? what is it with those?
Yeah, three very, very violent near-death experiences with cars. Yeah, I'm very happy I made it out of my my teens.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm also very glad that I live in Brooklyn and my own kids have no access to cars.
We have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about the quotes and soundtracks at the beginning of chapters, and when, at what point in the writing did those come in?
Those came in, they were sprinkled throughout the book, but woven into the text. I had a lot of music and quotes woven in, because the book is also about the sort of anxiety of influence and my worry that I didn't have an authentic self and that I was made up of nothing but other people's writing and song lyrics. So when I came up on the structure of alternating chapters, I just pulled everything out and made that much more explicit by putting them at the beginning of each chapter. And that allowed me to sort of set the tone for each chapter and have a real soundtrack going through, since music is so integral to the book.
Mm. In closing, I can't believe we're at the end of our time already. Could you offer any advice or words of wisdom to the writers of memoir or essays who are listening?
Well, persistence, and also really apply the fictive tools. If I could recommend any book about the process, I would recommend Vivian Gornick's The Situation and the Story. Mm-hmm. That was a pivotal book for me because she uses her own writing as an example. And so, she considers her first book a failure, even though it was spectacular material about falling in love with a revolutionary in Egypt. And her second book, which was much more successful, called Fierce Attachments, which is, if you just describe it in one sentence, is long walks with my really difficult mother.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an amazing book, just because she's figured out how to actually tell a riveting story about her and her mother. So, that would be my biggest thing, is really finding what your actual story is versus relying on your situation. And I see that with Tin House all the time. I see people with really spectacular material, like they were on the front lines in Fallujah, but, we all have CNN. We all know kind of what that was like, but what I want to know is what it was like really, particularly for you.
Mm-hmm.
Just if it's just an individual story, that's what I'm looking for.
Mm. Rob Spillman, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. That was Rob Spillman. His book is All Tomorrow's Parties, published by Grove Atlantic. If you just tuned in, this show, along with the others, will be podcast on penonfire.com. And you can go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when new shows are uploaded, you will get a little a little dealy bob in your iTunes inbox or in your podcast file or whatever you have on your computer or phone or iPad or what have you. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Lee Eisenman, literary agent in New York. So don't go anywhere.
Now let me tell you something, I'm gonna say it just one time. If I don't mess with your woman, then you better not mess with mine. Hey, just because I'm drinking, it don't mean that I'm drunk. Oh no. And if I catch you trying to do me wrong, I'll put a lump on your stomach. Now let me tell my woman the way it's got to be. I'll give you anything in the whole wide world, but you gotta be true to me. Girl, just because I'm drinking, I tell you don't if I catch you trying to do me wrong, I'll put a lump on your stomach.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And you can go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and you'll receive a little dealy bob in your inbox when we upload new shows, which is usually every Thursday. In any case, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I spent the first half hour with Rob Spillman, and I am back with Lee Eisenman. And now I just have to find my notes. Lee joined HSG Agency in the fall of 2015 after working for a year at Folio Literary Management. She combines her legal background with her love of books as a junior agent with HSG, building her own client list, and as counsel with Lyons and Salky Law, providing legal counsel to authors and publishing professionals. Let's bring her on. Hi, Lee.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Great to have you on.
Thanks so much.
I know you come from a law background, but instead of reading your bio, I thought it would be more interesting to hear you talk about your path to becoming an agent.
Sure. It was not the most direct path, but we all end up where we're supposed to be, I believe. I was an English major in college, and I grew up in Texas, but I knew that I wanted to live in New York, and so I thought I either wanted to go into publishing or be a lawyer. I did an internship in publishing in college, which I actually really loved. But then I sort of got in my head that I wanted to go to law school and be a lawyer. So I did that, and I practiced law for about 10 years in the city, but I sort of never lost my interest in the publishing world and in being a little more creative. I used to take online writing classes, and I would do the homework assignments in my law firm office late at night when I had put aside my legal work. And after about 10 years of practicing, I sort of did a little soul searching and thought, you know, this corporate law gig might not be what I want to do for the rest of my life. And, you know, what can I really imagine doing and loving for years and years? And the answer is publishing. So I to find my way into publishing, I talked to anyone who had any remote link to someone in publishing and eventually found my way into an internship at Folio Literary Management in the summer of 2014. It was a little interesting being in my mid-30s and interning unpaid alongside college freshmen, sophomores who were, you know, their first jobs, and they were living at home, and there was an intern happy hour, and almost nobody was 21. But I learned a lot from the internship, and I actually, you know, I had been prepared to put aside my legal background just to focus on books and agenting, but I found that my legal background was actually pretty helpful. So Folio hired me to do their contract work, to review and negotiate their contracts, and then I assisted a couple of the agents as well. So I worked there for a little over a year, and then I moved over to HSG, Hannigan, Salky, and Gessler, where, interestingly enough, of the seven of us in the office, three of us are lawyers and agents. So there seems to be some overlap in people drawn to the law and to literature.
Well, and I think as well for authors, an agent who is also a lawyer is sort of, you know, kind of a good deal, because it most likely means that your agent has a clue about business and can help you sort of on the editorial side and as well on the business side, which is kind of crucial for most authors who have no legal background.
Definitely. And you can look at a publishing contract. The first time I saw a publishing contract, I was shocked that it was a 20-page document with very dense paragraphs. And I sort of didn't realize before, you know, learning more about them, just all of the different provisions and all of the rights that you were licensing. And so it's nice to not be afraid of contracts. And I've worked with people who, you know, would get a contract for their client and sort of just pass it along without, you know, they would look at the business terms, but they don't really want to get into the nitty-gritty. Whereas as a lawyer, I read every line of every contract. And, you know, I'm not afraid to ask questions or, you know, advocate for a change in the legal document.
Yeah, interesting. You know, if you look at Publisher's Lunch, and hopefully everyone listening knows about Publisher's Lunch as being a great place to learn about publishing and agents and all sorts of things. There are so many agents, and with all the self-publishing going on, I'm curious if there are still many books being published the traditional way. And I'm thinking, because there's so many agents, they must be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, it's changing all the time. And publishing is a somewhat, traditional publishing is a slow industry and takes a sort of cautious approach to new technology. But, you know, at one point, ebooks were not the norm. And now you know, it's sort of alternating back and forth whether ebooks outsell print books or not. I think right now we're seeing a rise in print books. I think it depends on the goal of the particular author, but I think ideally, you know, every author wants to be published in a, you know, in a physical version that their friends and audience around the country can go to the bookstore and buy the actual book or order it off of Amazon. But it, you know, it really depends, and there are other avenues, and we're seeing a lot of great independent publishers, places like Catapult. I think Catapult is Catapult and another company are just merging, and I'm blanking on the name. Counterpoint. Yeah. Counterpoint, based in California, and Catapult are merging up. But there's a whole bunch of smaller independent publishers that are a little more niche and are putting out some really great books. So it's good to be open to different avenues.
Well, speaking of smaller publishers, it seems like it wasn't that long ago that agents didn't really want to deal with small publishers because the advances were so teensy. And I'm curious how that has changed. And are agents more likely today to pursue editors at small publishers? And how small is too small?
I think we are more open because we sort of have to be, and you know, we're seeing a lot of consolidation across the bigger traditional publishers, and it's sort of getting to be almost a Hollywood model where, you know, they'll take on a big blockbuster, you know, a big summer blockbuster movie in the movie theaters, or something like Amy Schumer's book where, you know, the publisher reportedly paid millions of dollars for this great title, guaranteed to sell a lot, but then they're buying fewer books, you know, fewer debut novels or fewer books by lesser known entities. So I think agents now have to be, you know, sort of have a wider perspective and be willing to reach out to all sorts of imprints and publishers for their clients.
So talk a little bit about what you represent, what you look for to come in the door.
Okay. Well, as I'm still sort of new to the business. I've just been taking on my own clients for the past year. So I want to do pretty much a lit of fiction and nonfiction, you know, about 50-50. It's sort of nice to work kind of two different sides of the brain. You know, I love a good novel, so I'm looking for literary, upmarket, commercial fiction. I tend to like a strong character and voice a little more than I am into plot. And I know right now there's a real trend for the psychological thrillers, you know, sort of inspired by Girl on the Train and those novels. And I'm not sure what it is about me, but I'm just not into psychological thrillers, and I don't want to read about women in danger, and that's just sort of not where my heart lies in fiction. But I do like a good character. I like a vivid setting. I sort of don't mind a slower pace if the writing is really nice. And then on the nonfiction side, I love lifestyle, cooking, baking, food, health, nutrition, that sort of stuff.
Interesting. I am speaking with Lee Eisenman. She's with HSG Literary Agency in New York. Define upmarket, because that's a new term, a newish term that we've been hearing in the last, I don't know, year or so.
Yeah, well, it's funny. We were having this this debate in my office yesterday. We are getting a new information management system where we can keep track of editors and their interests. And we were talking about the sort of tags that we want to be able to check off. And I think there's some debate about the definition, but I think it's just, you know, it's something more than just the mainstream mass market paperbacks that you would find in your supermarket. So there's a sort of literary element to it, like the quality of the writing is really good, but it has some commercial appeal too, you know, either a strong plot or something that makes it a little more accessible to the reader.
Okay. Yeah. And book club fiction too. I've seen that on agent lists where you didn't used to see that.
Right. And I'm not sure how much difference there really is between upmarket, book club. I think commercial, maybe the writing can be a little more approachable and maybe less sort of experimentation with form and less concerned with the art of writing and more about a, you know, a really good story with heart that the reader can really, you know, get into.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about these bestseller lists, because, you know, everyone knows that the New York Times bestseller list is the one you really want to make. But I wonder if other lists are almost as important. I mean, for instance, you see Amazon bestsellers all the time. And I wonder, you know, if that's impressive to agents, if your agent shopping, you had an agent or somehow you sold the first book or a second book or whatever, you made the Amazon bestseller list. You didn't make other, you didn't make USA Today, New York Times, whatever. But what about the Amazon bestseller list? Because you see that just so much, right?
Yeah. Amazon is a really interesting player in the landscape, and they've sort of changed a lot about how we go about things. But Amazon, I don't know the exact number, but a significant majority of readers buy their books from Amazon. So if you're on an Amazon bestseller list, you're selling a lot of books. So I think an agent would definitely take notice of that. There's an agent, one of the founders of our agency, Jessica Salke, represents a client, Matthew Norman, whose second book called We're All Damaged was published by Amazon this summer, and Amazon made it available as a Kindle first. So I guess it's, subscribers to the Kindle reading program could download it for free for a month, and it's sold like gangbusters and continues to be one of the best-selling and literary fiction on Amazon. And I think because, you know, it was made available to a big audience and people loved it, and so they comment, and it just continues to buoy sales.
Interesting. What about self-published books? I mean, there's so many, and I am curious if you or the agency takes on clients who've self-published, and if you did take them on, would you try to sell their already self-published novel to a publisher, or would you be interested in what the new one is?
I think that's a little trickier. We don't tend to get too involved with self-publishing, but I would say we wouldn't turn down a previously self-published book if the writing was great and the agent really, you know, believed that it could sell traditionally as well. But the self-published marketplace is pretty crowded, you know, and again, most of this I think is available on Amazon, and there are just thousands upon thousands of books out there. So I don't know, when you're self-publishing, because I haven't gone through that with any clients, I'm not sure how you get your book read by the audience.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I hear of writers who are writing, say, erotica under a pseudonym, and they're doing a good making some good money. But I don't know of the people I know, actually. I mean, a couple have told me their pseudonyms, but you know, other than that genre, I don't know how people are doing. I don't hear much.
Yeah, I think there could be a lot of like sci-fi fantasy type stuff. Those books tend to be pretty quick reads and very page turny. So I could see that those could be successful. And, you know, someone finishes one and is looking for the next one, and Amazon with their logarithms, you know, might suggest some other self-published ones, but I'm not really too sure about how it works.
Yeah. Let's talk about query letters, because that tends to be the point of entry, I think, for authors, seeking agents. Can you talk a little bit about query letters for fiction and nonfiction and how they might be similar or different?
Sure. I'll start with fiction. Agents tend to get a lot of queries in a day, and, you know, can get 50 to 100 in a week, depending on the agent. So in terms of how to make yours stand out, a catchy subject line, And depending on an agent's email system, I can see the first sentence of an email in my inbox. And so if I see that they've addressed it to Dear Mr. Eisenman, that tends to, you know, sort of turn me off. So, you know, ideally you want to research agents that you're querying to make sure that they accept the kinds of project you're submitting. Is it something about them suggest to you that it might be a good fit for your project? So the more tailored it is, you know, the more likely you're actually querying an agent who likes the kind of stuff you write. And then I like, you know, I was taught that you need a good hook, a good log line, sort of a first sentence that really captures an agent's attention and makes me think, what is this story about? I need to read more. And then, you know, I like a little bit of a synopsis, so I know kind of the outline of the story, and then a little bit about the author, especially if the person has an MFA or, you know, some particular life experience that makes them the right person to tell the story. So that's on the fiction side. Nonfiction, I know a lot of agents tend to sort of reach out on their own and kind of do, you know, play around on the internet and find things that look interesting and reach out directly to someone and say, hey, have you ever thought of writing a book? But on the other hand, it's great to have a project come to you. So in that case, you can either put together a proposal. It helps if you have a full proposal that you know, even if it's not perfect and in the shape that the editor would turn around and immediately start, that the agent would be able to turn around and immediately send out. But if you have thought through what about your project makes it marketable, what other works are like it, you know, what you're trying to tell, what your story is, it's an outline of the chapters, a sample chapter, if it's a cookbook, some sample recipes, if it's, you know, something more narrative, a sample chapter or two, so the agent can really see your writing. And then with nonfiction, a lot of it has to do with platform. You know, if you're writing a cookbook, do you have a big following? If you're writing a memoir, you know, what's your fan base? You know, sort of, do you have a built-in market based on who you are and who you know and what you've been doing in your life?
Yeah, interesting. Are there red flags? You mentioned Mr. Eisenman, but are there other red flags that would kind of turn you off just at first glance?
If your query letter is not proofread, and every agency is different. My agency asks for the first 5 pages of your manuscript. If those 5 pages are sort of rife with typos and errors, it tends to indicate maybe you haven't proofread carefully. Maybe your story still needs a little editing. So I'd say that's a bit of a red flag. If let's see. That's the main one for me.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I tend to, I get a lot of queries for thrillers. I don't represent thrillers, and my website bio doesn't say I don't represent them, but it doesn't say that I do. So it's, you know, those are easy ones to just sort of write back and say, you know, I'm so sorry, but I don't represent this category, and you know, I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah,
so.
And you mentioned in terms of a query letter, the bio, and if you have an MFA, mention that, or kind of maybe what your platform is. But what about for new writers who perhaps don't really have a platform and they don't have an MFA and they're just starting out at whatever age? What would you suggest for, you know, that bio portion of the query letter?
Oh, it's funny. Actually, I got a query a couple of weeks ago from a person in college. Still, I think she is a college junior, but she wants to write, and she sent me a few pages of a novel that she's working on. And I would say generally you don't want to query someone unless you have a completed project.
Uh-huh.
But if you have no MFA and you've never published anything, that's absolutely fine. Everyone has to start somewhere. It's just, you know, it will be a matter of whether your writing is great and the agent wants to take you on. But, you know, there are plenty of debut novels from people who don't have MFAs.
So it still comes down to the writing.
Absolutely. It's hard to avoid that.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid that. Getting back to small presses. So if a writer has a smaller publisher interested in a project, because it does seem to be easier for writers to contact small publishers and have them respond. You have a small publisher interested in a project. Would it make sense for that writer to deal directly with the publisher to continue on that way, or to use that interest to get an agent?
I might have a bit of bias in this area, but I think it's best to have an agent for a number of reasons. You know, you want someone on your side to advocate for you and who's looking out for your interests and who knows how to navigate the system, especially if you're a first-time writer. And you want to maintain an entirely positive relationship with your editor and your publisher. And so an agent can step in and be the bad guy if necessary in a way that you might not want to have to if something comes up. So I recommend working with an agent if you can. And having a publisher interested is a great way to get an agent to say, oh, yeah, I'll take a look at your project.
Yeah. And speaking of authors and agents, what is the protocol when you're with an agent, but you really want another agent? Should you just completely cut ties first and then let the agent that you're going after know that you were with an agent? They maybe sold a project for you, maybe they didn't, and you know, you've left them. I mean, how much history really do you need to tell agents that you are interested in?
I think I'm a big fan of full disclosure. You know, you don't want things to come up later that, you know, the agent might have appreciated knowing ahead of time. If you have a particular agent in mind and you're still with someone else, you know, that might be a little trickier and I would tread carefully, but you know, you as an author are always welcome to terminate a relationship that's not working for you. So, you know, whether you contact the agent that you'd like to work with while you're still with your bad agent, you know, that's up to you, because there's a chance maybe the new agent for some reason is not in a position to take you on and you don't want to burn the bridge of your current agent. But generally, you know, if someone has been represented by an agent before and they're querying me, I want to know what happened with that agent. And especially, you know, you can look on Publishers Marketplace and see prior sales, not all sales are reported, but you know, if someone published a book and it only sold 35 copies and now they're looking for a new agent, that sort of makes sense. If they had a successful book with an agent, it would probably, you know, I would wonder why they were leaving. Mm-hmm. So I think it's you know, it's like a failed dating relationship. You know, do you tell your next boyfriend what happened with your last one? But I think it's a good way to learn about, you know, what works for you in a relationship or not.
Yeah, interesting. And sadly, we're at the end of our time. Do you have any advice for the writers listening who perhaps have a finished novel or a book proposal and they're shopping around looking for an agent? Anything you could tell them?
Have a couple of people read your book or your proposal, excuse me, and give honest feedback. Have people you know will tell you the truth. You know, it never hurts to do one extra round of polishing. And otherwise, just, you know, really do your research. There's a lot of information out there about agents, you know, whether it's a bio on the website or you find someone has a Twitter or an Instagram that's public and you can learn a lot about the person. And, you know, try to find someone that really you think will get what you're doing. And just keep writing because it's a discipline and it's interesting, you know. Not everyone thinks they can get up on stage and sing a song, but a lot of people think that they can write a book. And it's, you know, it's a gift, but it's also a discipline and a skill that you really have to practice. And so I think the more you write and the more you read, the better your writing will be.
Mm.
And as we said, at the end of the day, it's still about the writing.
Thank goodness. Lee, thank you so much. You've been great. And thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome. That was Lee Eisenman. She's with HSG, Literary Agency in New York. And if you just tuned in, I'm going to be podcasting the show in probably within a week. So you can catch it on penonfire.com or subscribe to iTunes, and you'll get notice when we upload it. Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we'll see you back here next week.